Coming up next, another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.
Welcome to another edition of Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president, Local 237 Teamsters. And our very special guest, first time on Reaching Out, is Congressman Dan Goldman. Congressman Dan Goldman was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2022. He represents the 10th Congressional District, which includes all of Lower Manhattan and Western Brooklyn neighborhoods, including Red Hook, Gowanus, Prospect Heights, Prospect Park, Park Slope, Sunset Park, as well as portions of Borough Park and Bay Ridge. In 2019, Dan Goldman served as lead counsel for the impeachment investigation of President Trump for abusing his office for his personal interests regarding Ukraine. In that role, Goldman led depositions, questioned witnesses in the public hearings, and testified before the House Judiciary Committee. Prior to that, Goldman served for a decade as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. Congressman Goldman and his wife, Corrine, live in Lower Manhattan, where they are raising their 5 children. Congressman Dan Goldman, welcome to Reaching Out.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. It's great to be here with you.
Very good. So we will begin by asking you about your stand on gun violence. I know it's a major concern to you. It is to all of us, at least all of us who have sense. Could you share with us, our listeners, this is a priority in your office, and what are some of the measures you have taken to address this critical problem?
Well, it is an ever-increasing problem, Greg. As you well know, gun violence is now the leading cause of death for children in our country. As cars have gotten safer, guns have not. And so I've jumped in full force since I got into Congress in January 2023. First, I became a vice chair of the Gun Violence Prevention Task Force. Then I started the Gun Violence Prevention Working Group in the Dad's Caucus, because as a father of 5 with a kindergartner and first grader who have gone through active shooter drills, we need to elevate the pervasive problem of gun violence to our families, to parents, which crosses over political party, because everybody now, whether you're Republican or Democrat, worries that your child is going to go to school and either deal with a traumatic active shooter drill or actually have to deal with mass shooting, which is just happening almost 2 times a day now. So with that in mind, those are some of the longer term issues where we're working on gun safety legislation, trying to push it forward, trying to elevate it, trying to really keep the public's attention and draw the public's attention to the common sense gun safety laws that can just make people safer while still allowing people who can have guns to get them. Red flag laws are critical. Safe storage laws are critical. Universal background checks, and they're high capacity magazines. There are so many simple laws that are just designed to keep weapons of war out of the hands of people who should not have them. And it is bewildering to me that this is not a bipartisan issue, especially when you have the supermajority of Americans who support this legislation. But since that is a longer term goal, I'll just talk about a few of the sort of smaller incremental things that we're trying to do. The first is we wrote a letter to both the ATF and to the mayor of New York about reports that a gun buyback program, that gun buyback programs can actually lead just to a revolving door of guns on our streets. And that what happens sometimes is that serialized guns are given back through a buyback program. Then they're gone. Then they're sent to be quote unquote destroyed. But what actually happens is it's just the serialized part that officially and technically makes it a gun that is removed. The other parts of it are packaged up and they're sometimes resold online as a kit so that you can easily make a ghost gun if you find that extra piece and you're able to put together that extra piece. And so we're urging the ATF to change their regulations. And we actually got a very good response from the city on that in terms of that they actually ensure that their guns are destroyed, outright destroyed, which they have to pay for. And then the other thing, last thing I'll mention on this, and I obviously could go on about it forever, is last month in New York City, we held a string of events that we called New York 10 Alliance Against Gun Violence Week. And we had a series of events. I had a fireside chat with Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. We did a roundtable with survivors and victims. And then we had a stakeholder roundtable with a lot of the community-based organizations that are fighting the demand for guns. And after that, it was great. We came back to DC and co-sponsored the Break the Cycle of Violence Act, which would provide grants for community intervention programs so that we can figure out a way to cut the demand for guns.
Now, what I don't understand, police officers have to go through background investigations, psychologicals, and training to carry firearms. Police officers, we pay them to do this. We only allow them to carry 9mm, and in special cases, we have SWAT units that carry these weapons. So why would any of us just allow someone to go in the store, buy a gun, no training, no background check, no investigation, no screening, no psychological, and they could just buy a gun? When we have police officers who have to go through the training, the background investigations, and psychologicals, why on earth? I never understood that logic.
You're talking too much sense, Greg. That's the problem. But I have asked this question a million times, and the best answer that I have gotten is that there are gun owners, and first of all, there are many gun owners who are happy to have background checks because they understand they own a gun and they want to be able to own a gun, but they also want to make sure that everybody who owns a gun should own a gun or is capable of owning a gun. But there are many others, and especially Republicans and the gun lobby, who create this false narrative that there is a slippery slope to taking away your guns. And that what these incremental, purely gun safety laws are designed to do is to open up a wedge, and then it's going to be a domino effect. And ultimately the end goal is to take away your guns. That is just simply not true. But that is the manipulation of the gun lobby that says, you know, if you just have to put your gun in safe storage, or you need to have a background check to be sure that you're not a felon or a domestic, you don't have an order of protection or something like that, that somehow that is going to lead to qualified people not being able to buy a gun. It's illogical, it's irrational, it's wrong, but it is the messaging that is pervasive in and causes, I think, this stalemate.
Now, in New York City, last week on our subways, we had a shooting where someone was shot in the head with a gun. Ironically, the person who was shot in the head with the gun was shot in the head with his own gun that got taken away from him.
In that case, there are reports of serious mental illness on the part of the person who possessed the gun. Yeah. And that's where we need to really clamp down, both in terms of red flag laws, and New York has good red flag laws. And to be clear, red flag law complies with due process. And as a lawyer, I'm very concerned about due process. But this argument you hear from the right that they're trying to take away your guns without due process to determine whether or not you actually have a mental illness sufficient to to refuse for you, refuse you to be able to get a gun is false. Red flag laws are designed to create a process, a due process, to assess whether someone is has the proper mental health to be able to be qualified to own a gun. But you can take away the gun temporarily first and then go through the process. You don't have to go through the process and then take away the gun. That is still due process if it's done as it ordinarily is within, you know, a few days or weeks. And in this situation, background check, universal background check, is also essential, because even though New York has background checks, what we really need is to make sure that anyone who is transacting a gun, doesn't matter if you're going through an official gun dealer or not, needs to have a check for this exact reason. And if they qualify then for a red flag, then they're referred over to that process. But the combination of the prevalence of guns and mental health issues is really, really causing significant danger, significant violence, and significant public disorder and insecurity.
You're listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, President of Local 237 Teamsters. With us, our very special guest is Congressman Dan Goldman. Affordable housing is another issue that you have been working on. Tell us about some of your initiatives. What are you doing, such as legislation for low-income housing and tax credit bills?
The cost of living and the cost of housing, as your listeners know all too well, is just going through the roof. And one significant reason for that is that the housing supply is not keeping up with the housing demand. And so rents are skyrocketing. Now, a quarter of New Yorkers pay more than 50% of their income on rent. That is just unacceptable. And so we are doing a few things to try to facilitate more construction of housing up and down the spectrum. We need affordable housing, and we just need more housing because of natural supply and demand, which will bring prices down. The one thing on the federal level that I've been working on is I push very hard to include the low-income housing tax credit in the recent bipartisan tax bill that passed through the House but is now stalled in the Senate. That is an avenue through which the federal government can assist local developers to build affordable housing. And that's one step. It is not the solution, but it's one step. We need to make sure that our state legislature and governor in Albany reaches some sort of a housing agreement that will incentivize building, that will protect renters and tenants, and that will start to build the housing stock that we all desperately need. And the last thing I'm doing is I have 31 NYCHA developments in my district, and I spend a lot of time at them, meeting with the residents and the tenants association leaders. And I spend a lot of time dealing and trying to put some controls and accountability and enforcement over NYCHA. I co-lead with Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez, who's been such a great supporter of public housing, on the Public Housing Emergency Response Act, which would provide more than $30 billion to NYCHA for capital improvements. But we need to make sure that our public housing developments are upgraded and that people can live there with the dignity that everybody deserves.
Thank you. Thank you very much, because we represent the largest unionized workforce in public housing in NYCHA. On the topic of housing, you also introduced the Public Housing Emergency Response Act to allocate $70 billion for public housing capital repairs and upgrades. What is your goal here?
Well, you know, our goal is to get federal funding to renovate NYCHA. And I say that, obviously, to renovate almost the entire assortment or stock of NYCHA. Now, some have been slowly getting rebuilt and rehabilitated through other pathways of funding. But this is, the federal government has simply failed public housing around the country. And there's a Faircloth Amendment, which is, which prevents federal funding for direct, prevents some federal funding for public housing, which is a barrier that is unnecessary. I also just recently co-sponsored the Green New Deal for Public Housing, which is another way of upgrading our NYCHA developments while making them environmentally friendly, clean energy, creating jobs, and improving the facilities. That's another avenue to doing that. The frustrating thing, Greg, I'm not going to lie to you, is these don't have a chance of passing in this Congress.
Right.
And very little has a chance of passing in this Congress. Even bills that are bipartisan are not getting on the floor because this Republican majority is so opposed to bipartisanship. The extreme right, which controls what goes on the floor, believes bipartisanship is a four-letter word. And the speaker will not use up what little capital he has with the far right on something that is not essential. And I can't tell you how many bipartisan bills have come through committees and they're waiting to go on the floor and they just are not put on the floor. Now, it's not going to be, you know, funding for public housing. It's not that's not something that would ever be a Republican priority. So we're going to have to keep fighting and building coalitions and advocacy to push for that, to push for more Democrats to get elected so that we can continue to build support and help our public housing developments and residents. But it has been incredibly maddening that even other bipartisan bills do not get to the floor.
I remember in 2008, former President Bill Clinton came to a housing development with the then Secretary of HUD, Alfonso Jackson, and they announced a green initiative. And it was rehabbing and rehabilitating some of the developments there and creating jobs. And I just thought, I said, I wonder, is that program ever going to get off the ground? And of course it didn't. But I just remember that initiative, and that was under the George W. Bush presidency.
Right.
So, I mean, there was a slight attempt, and that was bipartisanship, because former President Clinton and Alfonso Jackson, who worked for the Republican president. And that was the last I've heard of a green initiative in public housing, at least here in New York City. Affordable childcare is also an issue that you've been focused on too. How will you expand the child tax credit that signed into law this year and help parents cope with the high cost of this year's vital services?
Well, the child tax credit that was passed during the pandemic was the single most successful poverty reducing bill in our history. It reduced child poverty by between 40 and 50%. And it was miraculous. The Republicans, of course, do not like that. They do not want spending. They certainly don't want spending to help families that really need it, that are not their donors and special interests. So they did not renew it. In this most recent bipartisan tax bill that I mentioned related to the low-income housing tax credit, we were able to include an increase in the child tax credit, not to the extent that it was during the COVID rescue plan, but it is such a smart policy that helps people just pay their bills that are outstanding, that weather some sort of an unexpected development, be able to budget, be able to save. And it has, it had such a tremendous impact, so that we are going to keep pushing it. I'm a co-founder of the Dad's Caucus. As a father of five, I understand all of the different strains and stretches on families and how difficult it is. And affordable childcare, universal childcare is such smart spending. And one of the frustrating things I find down in Washington is that Republicans view the deficit as a one variable issue, spending. They do not think about revenue. But take, for example, that because of child care needs and the lack of affordable child care, 5 million women in America leave the workforce every year, costing the economy more than $700 million. If we invest in affordable child care, universal child care, we keep those parents within the workforce, with on their career path, and we are able to actually benefit the economy by as much as 2 times whatever the cost is. So families need this so that we're not choosing between our children and our careers and our jobs, which then, of course, has trickle-down effects on other costs. And it makes sense from a financial standpoint. So one of the things that we are really focusing on in the Dads Caucus is pushing forward with an assortment of arguments as to why universal childcare is so important, including a fiscal one that hopefully will resonate with Republicans.
I know that there is a push to have a national abortion ban. There are some in power that would rather have nobody have birth control, no abortions, but you don't want to take care of the children that are here. You want more to be born, not to be taken care of. And the two policies do not make sense. We want you to have children, but we won't help you take care of them.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of this combination of combining church and state, which, and of course, our country is founded on the idea that church and state should be separate.
Yes,
but it's more than that. It is a desire for mostly Republican men to control women. And I don't say that lightly. Because when you look at the Dobbs opinion and you look at the fact that now so many states are taking away right to abortion and there is a real threat of a national abortion ban, which prohibits women, forces women who don't want to have children to have children. And then you look on the other side and you've got the Alabama Supreme Court and others who are pushing for this, who effectively want to ban IVF treatment or, you know, birth control, as you point out. That would mean that they are preventing women who want to have children from having children. And the only logical explanation to reconcile those two things is they just want to control women. And when you look at the statistics around the country, 80% of the votes around the country in support of abortion bans are from men. And it is something that not just women need to rise up and speak out, but we men also need to do that because it affects our families. And it also is just the tip of the iceberg. It's coming for us. It's coming for the LGBTQ community. It's coming for any number of different communities that they don't like. And if they can control women, they can control anything else. And that is really what the objective is. And that's why it is so important to elect Democrats and so important to beat back this craze, this desire for abortion bans around the country, including a federal abortion ban.
Okay. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this edition of Reaching Out. Can we get together with your scheduler and see if we could come back and continue the conversation?
Because I would love to.
More questions.
I would love to.
Okay, you've been listening to Reaching Out. I'm Gregory Floyd, president of Local 237 Teamsters. With us, a very special guest, Congressman Dan Goldman. He was it was a nice, fruitful discussion. Thank you for coming on Reaching Out.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to tune in again each and every Saturday at this same time for another edition of Reaching Out with Gregory Floyd, president of Teamsters Local 237.